Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Lee Piccarella.
Dr. Hunter Stevens.
And Jessica.
Welcome to the Head Game, powered by Mindful Athlete Training, episode number 53. Trick or treat when Halloween and psychology meet somewhere at the corner of Elm Street, where we may meet creatures like Freddy Krueger, Jason Voorhees. We're going to be talking today about paranormal activity, what makes us so afraid, the psychological variables behind it, and a whole lot more. So sit back, grab your popcorn, maybe have some healthy Halloween treats, and join us for a scary, spooky tale.
Do your laugh.
Ew. Hello, everyone. Hello, and welcome to our Halloween edition podcast. My name is Dr. Lee Piccarella.
Dr. Hunter Stevens.
And I'm Jessica.
And welcome back to another edition of The Head Game, where week in and week out, we are trying to bring you the absolute very best of the psychological world. And I myself today, now we're going to throw something out today early. For those of you who like to watch, who have been our loyal listeners and viewers, we're trying to figure out what best names we would have in the present form that we are taking, celebrating Halloween a full week early, because the Head Game crew is not going to be here next week. And so if you've got any of those thoughts, if you want to send us a quick message or let us know what names would best suit us, that'll certainly get things going and add a little extra spice to our witch's brew. Today's discussion is all about trick or treat, the relationship between psychology and the wonderful holiday known as Halloween. And we're going to talk about the paranormal activity phenomenon and what about psychology brings out those elements. How are we doing today? I think we need to definitely come up with a name for you. the life that starts to consume us with the characters that we wear, what is it about Halloween in general that just kind of brings out the inner actor silliness? Thank you, podcast.
Wow.
Mike,
that was a really big change.
It was a big change. I can't hear myself, so I'm very distraught that I can't hear myself. That's much better if I just kind of hold my ear to the headphones. So Halloween.
Yeah, I think that Halloween is something that you kind of get to be your unquestionable self, like truly, like the part that you wouldn't really want to show, but it kind of gives you that 24-hour free, I don't know the word, but whatever the word is, like you can just go out and like be who you want to be that you wouldn't be, like that creepy side of you. We all have it. I know I definitely had it. I was like a really weird kid. And my mom was like, Jessica, you're going to be Cinderella. And you know who I wanted to be? And I would cry. I wanted to be Gollum from The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And I would crawl around. Like, think how creepy that is. I was in, like, kindergarten. I would crawl around and, like, go in. And I'd be like, my precious. Or Schmeagle, whatever you want to call him. So, but to be fair, I was young. I was innocent. And that was a new... That was something that I haven't explored yet in myself, that like darkness, I think, because now that like would totally creep me out if I was crawling around my house and like just sitting in the darkness for people. Like, that's weird. I get it.
Yeah.
How about you there, you big hairy ape?
Hey, our kind takes offense to that, but thank you for calling us apes and not monkeys. I think Halloween for me has always been an opportunity to kind of be a kid. And what I mean by that is that it allows us to always kind of have that fun, curious nature in our hearts. It's a time of kind of mischief. It's a time of exploration. It's a time of friendship. It's a time of going up to a stranger's house and trusting others and then kind of getting excited. And then as we grow up, it also gives us the opportunity to kind of relive those memories in a different way, a different experience. It's a way to collaborate and connect with others again, and just have fun.
Yeah.
And not a lot of times in our lives do we get to just have fun.
So when I think about Halloween, it has a lot to do with obviously sort of connecting with your childhood, but also having that opportunity to really be any character that you want to be for that, with that freedom that it can exist in one evening. And because it's only one night, or it's that one party that you're going to, it's very much an all-in mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think off the top of my head, and I want to know from each of you as well, what are some of the characters that you've played, or what your was your favorite costume, either growing up as a kid or even as an adult, that you have the fondest memories of?
You want to go first?
Okay. I don't remember right now, actually, who I've been.
Okay.
But I do know I've always been really, really interested in being like a spy, like a ninja. I really want to be like a ninja in real life. I've always have. Like, oh, Tomb Raider. That was one of my favorites that I was. Lara Croft.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Period.
There you go. How about you?
I've had a few throughout my time. Again, as a, kind of my growth era. One that I was pretty proud of was, I believe his first name's Aaron. I'm not quite sure his last name, but he was the man from 27 Hours, or 127 Hours, who had to, he was in like the Red Rock Canyons and fell and got his arm wedged and had to cut his own arm off. So I dressed in all hiking gear with a headlamp and actually then tucked one of my arms kind of into my pants and then stuffed the sleeve and tied a flannel shirt. So kind of one of the arms was missing in maybe a slightly sadistic way. So I got to be him for one Halloween. And that was a fun one. Yeah, that was a good one. I mean, I've been a ton. I did Ace Ventura one time, so my hair was kind of sticking up.
I had
the tutu. I had the Hawaiian shirt that came. We were going out at 8. It came out like 7:45 through Amazon. Shout out Amazon. Not that they need it. And so that was a fun one too. That I was kind of getting to wear like big boots, like shorts. It was a fun one to kind of be just kind of crazy.
So as a child, I kind of did all of the basics. You know, I did Spider-Man one year. There was when I was in grade school, I had this ridiculous notion that I was comfortable enough in my own skin. I was in fifth grade that I could actually dress up as a girl to kind of wow all of my friends, that I could totally transform. And my mother took the task of dressing me up way too seriously and did my hair. She did my makeup. She found some type of dress, and it was like the late arrival Halloween parade in grade school. So everyone got to go into school a couple hours later. Mm-hmm. And it's about 10 a.m. and I'm standing in front of the full length mirror dressed up as a girl, and I completely lost my shit and just was freaked out, and I cried hysterically, and I was like, I had all this fear of being judged, and there was no way that I was going to let that happen. So I completely bailed on the idea, stripped it all off, like washed my face, and I think my mother, just out of frustration and last minute necessity, grabbed the sheet, put two holes in it, and put it over my head, and I went as a ghost.
The classic.
I also topped Halloween as an adult, and I think maybe it has something to do with the profession that I'm in, which in large part has a lot to do with what we're going to talk about today, the relationship between psychology, the paranormal, Halloween, or All Hallows Eve. What that's about, what it activates in us, people who like to dress up, be scared, so many things about that. But some of my favorite costumes as an adult were, I was an Oompa Loompa one year from Willy Wonka. I was Pugsley from the Addams Family, which actually led me to Salem, Massachusetts, which is a story for maybe later in the show. I was a 50-pound bag of cocaine, which was hands down the most creative.
So how does that work? Do you put like powder on yourself?
I dressed in all white. So I was in long johns, long sleeve for bottoms and tops. I had white gloves. I had a big white Albert Einstein wig. I painted my face white, and I got a shower curtain, which I stapled in half along the seam, and I got two bungee cords, and I had a big plastic bag in front of me in the back, and I filled the front and back with 25 pounds of flour on either side. It literally was a 50-pound bag, which I just nestled over my shoulders, and I walked in as a giant bag of cocaine, and my wife was a $100 bill. my personal favorite was she was this incredibly ornate cloud with silver cotton hair. My wife is very creative. And I was a picnic table with a fork and a knife with about 1,000 strands of string all over me and giant loofahs that we spray painted as meatballs stuck to my picnic table. So we were cloudy with the chance of meatballs.
Oh, very nice.
Yes. So there lies the creativity. The frustrated artist, I think, sometimes. So what is it about Halloween that allows people to kind of tap that darker side? Or what is it about being scared or frightened that might, you know, entice some but maybe, you know, drive others farther away?
Yeah. I think about this all the time. Like, why do people, and half of the people who you talk to and say, like, why are you watching that movie? It's not supposed to be really scary. And they're like, yeah, I hate scary movies. And I'm like, oh, okay. But you're going to watch it? Yeah, I'm going to watch it. And it's like, well, why? And I think that I could get really psychological, which I'm going to go down that road. I think that it might have something to do with two things. I have to figure out how to say this correctly. One, I think that the fact that you know that it's like quote unquote fake can maybe reassure something in yourself, which is the part that I'm not sure makes too much sense right now. Or people who like them. This is a hard question for me. I've been thinking about it since like 3 days ago when we decided that we were going to do this. And I just can't put my, because I feel like people who are afraid of it maybe have something insecure about them. Maybe there's something traumatic that actually happened and they're like, no, I don't really want to go watch that because it's too real for me. And then you get to a more light sense where it's like, I just enjoy doing it because nothing's bad ever really happens to me.
Let's just break that down for a second. Let's just kind of talk about paranormal activity and do we think that goes on? It's very much, you know, the big draw for those types of movies. It's kind of like a reality show on steroids. You want to believe that it's true. If you believe in paranormal activity, somehow, some way, all of these movies have time-lapse video in every aspect of their house while the house is being haunted, which then conveniently documents paranormal activity. People always end up disappearing. Then there's like the statement of the bottom of like, you know, bodies were found, or it's all documented to the day and time. It reminds me of the original Blair Witch Project. Have either one of you guys ever seen that?
Yeah.
Right, the handheld.
Right. So it's the documentary style. It was very groundbreaking. It was someone recording themselves. It was, for those of you who don't know, it was a group of young 20-somethings that got lost in the woods. I think it took place in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a video, and how it was is how they introduced the movie. They almost made it like a breaking news story, like a video recorder was found. And as they unearthed all of these details, something really, really bad happened in the woods in the middle of the night, actually over the course of a couple of days when these young people went out for a hike and reportedly got lost. What is it about that? Does it allow us to safely just go there and maybe explore what we would do?
I think there's a few things with it. I think anything such as that has a fear based still, but also it has the opportunity for feeling courageous at the same time. And so in those kind of horror movies, I think we have an instinctual drive with fear to try to overcome fear, to try to watch it, to try to see what that oddity or normality is like, and kind of push the boundaries. And when we push our boundaries, we feel that fear. We feel the adrenaline that comes with fear. We feel that rush. We grab into our partners, right? We scream out loud. We start to kind of shake. We close our eyes, right? We cover our eyes. And I think that opportunity too, especially experience with others, creates a sense of a community, a bonding experience as well, where you go through something kind of traumatizing and a shared experience. But then it also gives you the opportunity to say, well, I've watched that movie. And whoa, that movie was so scary. How did you get through it? And it's, oh, I've seen it. I've gone it. It's almost like a badge of honor,
right,
to see the scariest movies.
Yeah, it's the that point of recognition that we're all looking for. It's like the, you know, you can coin yourself a daredevil or a risk taker. Mm-hmm. There's that special category of people that only really like to watch those intense movies, especially when you get into more movies about like the devil, you know, possession.
Mm-hmm.
Or that scares a lot of people. It just the sheer premise. What is it about that? Is it a what's your take on that? Is it purely a heaven versus hell? Is it the devil and what the devil stereotypically represents? It's not as if we have a lot of examples of the devil walking around or the devil that we feel that we know. What is it about that makes those things so scary?
Well, on Psychology Today, which, for those of you who don't know, it's just a platform where a lot of doctors post on just, it's kind of like their blog. So it comes from a more educated point of view, but, you know, still, they also like kind of highlight their own research. And I just quickly Googled and I found 5 reasons why we enjoy being scared. Mm-hmm. Critically thinking about gaining pleasure from fear, suspense. So he just very quickly said 5 things, which he explained. He is a Christopher Dwyer, PhD, don't know where. 1, the safety net.
Mm-hmm.
2, the flood. 3, self-satisfaction. 4, closeness with others. And 5, curiosity.
Did I not nail that or what? Just off the top of my head.
Is,
right?
is that your blogger name?
Are you Christopher Dwyer, PhD? Yeah.
Is that your ghostwriter name?
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's right.
Again, it's that connection with this, you know, especially when it's with a shared experience. I remember, hey, let's go watch this movie when I was, you know, 17, 18 years old with a group of friends. And, you know, there's some people who are like, kind of hesitant. Maybe you're a little hesitant too inside, but you're like trying to act, you know, a little bit tougher for certain individuals around in the group. And you go watch that group. But then when you come out of it, there's this kind of bonding that has happened as the shared experience that you've gone through that. And the connection, I think, is interesting. And though maybe you didn't enjoy it necessarily.
Right.
When it comes to the paranormal, as you kind of were talking about, I think we've talked about this previously. Like, I'm not a huge believer, I guess, in ghosts and stuff like that. And those type of movies don't scare me as much as, like, when it's a human-on-human interaction. When it tends to be more, I guess, something more physical or realistic-based.
Right.
That grounding is a little bit more shaky for me than maybe some of that paranormal or devilish.
So, like, give me an example. Like, I understand what you're saying, but
so like Paranormal Activities or like Sinister is supposedly like the most I think was just ranked the scariest movie of all time. They actually did a like heart monitoring of people watching it, and their heart rate jumped like 36% on average, which is like the most that's ever been by watching Sinister. But those movies are more demonish or paranormal. Versus like something like Saw or something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or,
right.
Others.
You're going back to, you know, allowing me to kind of go back into the annals of some old school movies. It's more like Friday the 13th,
uh-huh.
Nightmare on Elm Street with Freddy Krueger. You know, that's always the popular, like, you know, Scissorhands.
Right.
And of course, how could we not actually talk about the movie Halloween, which
Of course.
podcast Mike, if you could maybe bring up some of that theme music, any of that type of music with that piano, and you think about the character of Halloween is a very disturbed adult male. His name is Michael Myers.
There it is.
There it
A
is.
little chills.
Just
Is
let
he outside staring at us from a tree?
just let that sink in for a moment.
I'm
That's so
going to
good.
have nightmares from
That's
this podcast.
genuine fear.
I'll tell you, man. It's the killer. You can't
Well,
mess with the killer clown,
it's
man.
it's interesting you immediately go to the music of Halloween, right?
Oh,
Because it's
yeah.
so iconic. But the really, if you watch any scary movie, the sound really draws you in.
Completely.
The
Oh,
importance of
yeah.
sound, the importance of silence, the importance of the big jump scare, right?
Right.
It's not just him popping out, but it's like
That's the connection of the heart rate to me.
Yes.
It's the silent, it's the anticipation of the, you know, you're just kind of hanging. It's, oh shit! You know, it just, you know, it just.
As if I wasn't. I might end the podcast early on my part.
Well, hey,
I'm trying to find the scariest
wasn't this
movies
your
of
idea?
all time.
Were you behind this,
Yeah.
or was it,
I
or was
told
it?
you, I used to love it, and then I moved away from it. Now I'm coming back. Maybe I'm feeling more like, okay.
Now
See?
that little jolt there, did that give you a little boost in heart rate? Because if we get into physiology, you see,
I mean, we have a biofeedback
why
lab.
people I think like that is
Yes.
because yes, it's unsettling, and yes, there's uncertainty, but the boost in heart rate is a genuine involuntary adrenaline rush. And I think a lot of people who go to those movies don't necessarily like the concepts, but they like the feeling of being scared because it's a very small window of experiences that can actually provide us with that, with the safety knowing, okay, if this is way too much for me, I can leave. I can get out. I can excuse myself. I can go to the restroom. I can turn away. So there's those safety measures, those precautions almost are built in.
Well, it talks about too the physiology, the importance of human physiology as it relates to kind of that stress or that fear moment. How it does jack us up, but then it's, oh, okay, it's everything's okay. And the relief that kind of comes with it. But that only occurs after the stressful moment, right? In our lives, in a movie, in an experience, it's the role that stress plays in us to kind of jump up our heart rate, give us the adrenaline, give us those endorphins, right? Leads to that moment, and then the relief, the recovery aspect of it, the ramp up to ramp down, is that okay? Everything's okay.
Yeah, it's
Okay.
almost like a workout, you
Right.
know? Because you know that you're going to get that high, but you also know that you're going to get the benefit on the backside when you start to crash.
Right.
And then it's also, too, to your point, badge of honor, I think, is spot on. Like, it's, you know, you literally want to pat yourself on the back and say, like, yeah, like, I did that. I pushed through my discomfort. You know, we all hear about, like, you know, my wife hates scary movies and I love them, but she comes to watch them anyway. Or you're like, oh, my girlfriend, you know, she doesn't like it, but, you know, I do. So I think it's that opportunity, that ability to connect. So we could go on and on about the Halloween. We could go on and on about Paranormal Activity. But for those loyal listeners out there, let's kind of just throttle back a moment. Let's get into a little who's got game. Jess, who do you have for us on tap today?
Yeah, definitely full 360. I chose Tyler Glass now. So for those of you of the oh, here we go. See what your scaring did? Now my words are all tied together. For those of you who do not know who he is, he's from the Tampa Bay Rays, and they're in the World Series right now. Feel free to watch tonight, 8:30. We're not getting sponsored by them, so we can edit that out. But why I thought that he was interesting was because he has carpal tunnel, and my first kind of the way that my mind went to that was I was thinking about esports. Mm. And we were part of an esports, the inaugural esports combine last weekend in Indianapolis. You guys can mention how that went. But I thought it was so interesting because you're thinking about those type of variables with esport gamers in particular, and you don't think of a pitcher getting carpal tunnel. But it's very common, I found. And actually, because of his carpal tunnel, he only has two pitches that are insane. He throws like a high, I think it's like mid-80s slider, which is ridiculous if you know speeds of pitches. And he throws a 100-mile-hour fastball, and that's kind of it. But that's how his fingers are. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that it was, you know, something that we don't really think about too often. Other kind of, I wish you go to the camera so Michael can zoom in on you doing that. Eat a grape.
I didn't eat a grape, but I will though.
Eat
I'll
a grape on the camera.
I'll work for the audience. She doesn't like this. Wait, there it is. Killer clowns have to eat. This is healthy Halloween. Like, we have to eat too, right?
That's how you're all bones.
Right.
Bad joke.
Ba-dum-bum.
But yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Just, well, why don't you kind of give us a quick recap of the esports combine, and then we can maybe talk about some of those things that sort of parallel with young Tyler.
Yeah, so October 16th through the 18th was the first inaugural 2020 esport combine out of Indianapolis. Of course, because of this year and the way that everything has been going, it was done virtually. So we co-sponsored the event. We were able to be a part of it and kind of share Mindful Athlete Training and introduce ourselves into the esports world. We were part of three panels as well as four networking events. We debuted our esport video, which you could be found on our YouTube channel as well. And we talked a little bit about leveraging physiology, what happens to a performer, physiology in moments of performance and challenges, especially in the esport domain, as well as how to increase overall mental wellness in the sport and the importance of both the physical and mental development of all athletes.
I think one of the things that I kind of took away from that is there were a lot of gamers, there were managers, there were coaches. A lot of people professionally more connected. Oh yeah, look at that. More connected to the industry that I had actually anticipated. And what it came down to was a lot of people were fascinated by the type of work that we were doing with the gamer in what we call our mental skills 2.0 philosophy, and assisting those gamers in real time with altering their physiology to peak perform, yes, but also really promoting a healthier way to play. Mm. And this has activated a huge conversation with Dr. Stevens and myself. We've actually reached out to a colleague of mine. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Peltzer-Jones. A little shout out to her, who works at the Henry Ford Medical Center out in Detroit, Michigan. And we've already discussed with her how this system that we have put together can implement a training protocol for emergency team, emergency room response members, doctors, residents, surgeons. If you just think about it, the impact that this type of training can have on any sort of high performer, and again, bringing it full circle, Jess, to your point, so many of these individuals have little aches and pains. Sometimes carpal tunnel, sometimes back problems from sitting too long, from standing too long, that become a natural inhibitor. And what we do really allows them to manage more effectively that direct pain response and gives them an opportunity to really kind of hone in on their craft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to your point, kind of speaking about our performance and how, again, when you have a physical ailment such as carpal tunnel or other things that are kind of pinging, if you ever had a little bit of lower back pain, which I've had in my career, or you've kind of stubbed your toe, or you've kind of even had a more recent burn or a scratch, you know how discomforting, or toothache, right? If you have a toothache, the only thing you can think about is that toothache. You can't think about the things around you. But that performance doesn't stop. So it's important to have some type of method. And training model to help individuals, especially in high performance situations, be able to recognize how that discomfort, that pain, what they're going through affects their ability to focus, their ability to be calm and regulate their emotions, and then ultimately engage and perform. So it's important for us to be able to drive that. So when you bring up carpal tunnel and someone who's kind of able to perform at a high level, he's aware of that. He's attuning to that. He's adjusted his game. And it's about that awareness of how do we make that adjustment versus how do we try to eliminate it, because it's always going to be there in some capacity. So in mindful athlete training, right, that's something that we encourage. But as you listening at home, thinking about how you're aware of those things, how you can react, how you can attune to it, so how you can modify, you know, your ability to be most at the highest level. How do you achieve the highest level when you do have those aches and pains? I think that's important to think about, because it's tough sometimes. The struggle is real.
Not only is it real, but I think that just let me take a little side break. How consuming is the role of the performer when you think about all of the elements that are at play? You think about all the variables. We're talking about Major League Baseball. We're talking about medicine. We're talking about esports gamers.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't imagine a panel of those three professionals ever relating to each other. But yet when you look at the premise of what we're trying to enlighten, empower, educate, it's all predicated on what's going on with our body when we're being asked to do something. Even as what we're doing now. Like when you think about like the common course of our job and you think about the variables that we become accustomed to. We've now done this podcast maybe a dozen times, probably a little bit less, but it feels like that. We've been on the radio for a number of years. The sheer element of introducing the mask and the outfit is a total different level of performance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Now, you might be comfortable in that look because that's your inner Harry Potter, whatever the character was that you mentioned earlier. What was that from?
Which character?
The one that you identify with. That you wanted to be.
Lara Croft?
Yes.
No, she's more of like...
Oh, no, I know her. The one from the... was it Lord of the Rings?
Oh, Schmeagol?
Yes. Yes.
So
when we wear wear a mask, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and this can actually sort of springboard into the concept of mask wearing in October of 2020 for a uniquely different set of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about our presentation when changed that either gets more in our head or sets us free?
You know, this reminds me of something. Like when you wake up in the morning and you get ready, you put a nice outfit on, whatever it might be, you feel better that day. And I feel like it kind of can correlate with Halloween. You're putting on this outfit of something that you subconsciously decided you wanted to be. And you are this whole new character. And you might wake up the next morning and you're your normal, boring self. But for that moment, it's funny how putting something on and looking in the mirror and being different than who you were kind of changes your whole just
persona.
Everything. Yeah, mm-hmm. For that day.
Yeah, exactly.
So I've been big with puns in some of mine, and one of my favorites is Hawaiian Punch. So I kind of put on boxing gloves, put on a Hawaiian t-shirt, and I was Hawaiian Punch one year.
That's clever.
But when I was walking around, and maybe some of the listeners or some of you have felt this, it's like, what are you?
Yeah.
Like, what are you this year? And it's like, oh, I put so much effort and thought into kind of creating this costume. And then somebody asks you, what are you? And it's kind of a deflating piece to it. And so kind of you're talking about getting dressed up, getting excited, getting ready to go out. Your confidence is up a little bit. You got to kind of be someone else different. And then the night comes, right? The something happens and things challenge us or don't go the way that we are scripting it out to be. And it kind of takes away from the night. And doesn't allow us to actually enjoy the experience versus you love your costume. You thought it was a great costume. You can still enjoy your costume even if someone doesn't quite get it right away. If things don't go necessarily according to plan, which they traditionally never do, especially on Halloween night as the kind of night rolls on. So kind of adjusting to it as well is important, because you do get excited and you're allowed to get excited and you should get excited about the things that you're wearing and doing, and be prepared to not write a script, but more so be in the moment and enjoy.
When I was in my 20s, my brother was dating someone who was a religious fanatic associated with the concept of Halloween. And every year she would organize a group costume for 8 to 10 people. And she would sort of scour the earth for group costume competitions. Huh. And we all literally went up to Salem, Massachusetts, which is
phenomenal.
Which, if you've never been there during Halloween, it is definitely a bucket list moment. The entire town is consumed by Halloween. And there is a Halloween gala ball at the Nathaniel Hawthorne Hotel, which has individual and group team awards presented. And they take it so seriously, they have a red carpet leading up to the hotel. And people gather and take photos that are roped off. And you have to kind of, you know, show your entry, you know, admission form.
Uh-huh.
And we went up there as the Addams Family. This is when I played Pugsley, just FYI. And we won. We took first place at the Nathaniel Hawthorne Salem, Massachusetts Halloween Gala Ball.
Why isn't that first on your bio every time I see
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, man, you talk about creativity. I saw this one young woman who was kind of dressed in a rather revealing negligee. She had her hair back, and she had glasses on, and she had a pencil behind her ear, and she was smoking a cigar. And I just went up to her, and I said, "What are you?" And she looked me dead in the eyes, and she said, as she smoked her cigar, she goes, "I'm a Freudian slip." That was one of my, why I remember that, for obvious reasons. I was a mid-20-something. I was single. But of course, I had just started my master's degree in psychology.
Yeah.
I thought it was fate.
Yeah. I have two questions. One, I want very serious answers. Hunter already said it, but he can re-say it. Do you believe in ghosts or spirits or whatever you want to call them? And number two, whether you're going out for Halloween or not, what character would you be, or who would you be this year?
This year?
And you can go first, because I happen to be staring at him the whole time. I think it's something with your hair is like attracting my eye today.
It's the whole killer clown
thing. That's honestly scaring me, so I'm choosing not to look that way.
I very much want to believe in ghosts.
Spirits.
I do. I would love to think that they are around, that they are amongst us as we speak, both for professional and personal reasons. I don't think there's enough evidence for that that's personally happened to me.
You have to see it to believe it type thing.
I do. I definitely do. Who I would be for Halloween this year, that is such a difficult question for me to ask. Other than this killer clown, which I think I've found my second alter ego, I've been many characters in my day. And if I were to do something, it would definitely be off the wall. It would be, I would like to think, different and creative, something that's thought-provoking, but would really allow me to absolutely cut loose. For me, it's not even so much the character, but it's the opportunity to just be free, to literally be without restriction. Another quick sidebar story. When I was at Lehigh, I was a senior. We used to have a holiday Christmas party in my fraternity, and there were four seniors that were selected by the house. One to be Santa Claus. Santa Claus had two elf helpers, and there was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And I was asked to be Rudolph, and the Rudolph was a full body suit, but I had a head that when you put it on, you actually look through his neck and he had full antlers and a red nose with a button that went down the side, and it was a finger trigger so you could light up the nose. Make a long story short, it was a phenomenal party, but afterwards, Dr. Lee felt that Rudolph needed to be shared with the world, so I actually went downtown in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in the Tally Ho, for anyone who ever's been to Lehigh University, which was the one bar at the time, which is where everyone went, and they let me get into the Tally Ho dressed as Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and I absolutely loved it, because you know what I learned really quickly when you go out dressed as Rudolph? In the early month of December, you can do anything you want.
Yeah.
Anything. You can go up and talk to people. You can high five people. You can do anything you want. It is a license to go batshit crazy. And I loved it. So to answer your question, full circle, I don't know who I would be, but it would be something that would give me the opportunity to just unleash whatever.
I kind of created something for you while you were speaking in my head.
Okay.
I feel like we could.
I don't know if I want to hear this, but go ahead.
I feel like I would kind of make your eyebrows angry. And then. Wait, hear me out. And then I would put like all different types of words on you in different languages. Can you guess who you are?
No.
You're a frustrated linguist.
I am a frustrated
That's
linguist.
That's a good one.
I would have to figure it out more, but. No, you know.
All different words from all different languages. Like, yes.
Yeah.
Good call.
That's a good one.
Because I am. I'm a frustrated
you
linguist.
You guys were giving me like really creative things, so I feel like I had to add in there. Now maybe I have some more.
Well,
rapport.
How about you there, big guy?
So for me, to begin, I guess, I said I don't really necessarily believe in as much in paranormal activity, but more so like I definitely believe in like there's definitely things around us, spirits, ghosts, kind of. Another dimension, I don't know, there's definitely something around us that kind of helps us interact with the world. Do they have malicious intent? Are they demon-esque? I think there's certain unexplained things, but at the same time, I think it's a cultural aspect that kind of drives us there. But do I believe in like the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot? Absolutely. So I'm kind of all over the place in my spectrum of belief and mystery. In terms of what I would be this year, well, I am traveling on October 31st. So I wouldn't necessarily be anything specific except comfortable. But I think, again, I guess my size allows me to be different things.
It does. It gives you a different license.
Right. I was thinking Gumby. So if you guys remember Gumby, right?
Big remember green Gumby.
Guy, played by Eddie Murphy at one point in SNL. But yeah, I think a large Gumby would be pretty good.
Look at
it would
him.
Be kind of funny and give me kind of the license to
hey,
kind of be free.
Hey, you know who he reminds me of? Do you remember vegetable people, the cartoons?
VeggieTales.
VeggieTales. Is he a VeggieTale? Google VeggieTales.
No, he's not a VeggieTale.
But to speak to your height, though, Gumby is not would not allow you to be.
Maybe a Jolly Green Giant now that we're looking at vegetables.
Uh-huh.
All right, never mind.
That would be cool. Jolly Green Giant.
It's similar.
Walking around with a little, couple of ears of corn.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, who would we be in this picture right here?
Well, Hunter would be the asparagus stick, for sure. You would be the little miss thing on the far right with the red hair and the. That's you, Jess.
Why?
Me, I would be the squash.
In the middle?
Far left.
Oh,
no,
far
that's
left.
I think that's a cucumber. I think that's, is that a squash? I think that's
a squash. It's a gourd of some kind.
A gourd of some kind. Yes.
I kind of think that I'd be
it's
that
very
little,
attractive.
That little pea next
just
to the person
to
you said I was. You see the little pea?
The on little the thing bottom. On the, yeah.
That's me.
That's you?
I see Michael with the hat on.
Yeah, that's Michael, definitely. Yeah. With
the hat on.
On
that podcast mic. It's very,
we just need to add some headphones. Tacky.
Yeah.
Some headphones and that's him.
For sure. Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, interesting.
What about you? What about you? Do you believe? Who would you be? Do you believe?
Do I? I grew up very spiritual, if you can't tell. I'm just such a wild soul.
You are.
No, but I really did. I grew up very spiritual. As I got older, so my question growing up, 100% I believe in spirits, whatever that may entail. And then as I got a little older, I realized how intertwined my religion that I was brought up was with the other side, per se. I didn't realize how, like, growing up Catholic, like, we really heavy go on the other side. So it kind of shifted a bit because, as you know, I have a more of a researching type mind. So I was like, okay. But I still believe in it. Now, my mother goes to bed every single night to Paranormal Activity shows called Ghost Adventures. Hmm. So when I watch that, half of the time, I don't believe anything I'm seeing.
So that tends to soothe her? She likes that?
Yeah, and... yeah, we can get into it. I know she's on the script. Uh-huh. I can explain her, but weird that it soothes her. But I don't know. I think that it's interesting that Hunter brought up the more like demon side of it. When I think of spirits, if I was to say I believe in them, it would be more positive. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's just me wishful thinking. As far as who I would be, I think that I would be one of two things. One, Guardians of the Galaxy. I'd paint myself green and be Gamora. Hmm. Or two, if any of you seen the Peaky Blinders.
No.
Yes.
You can bring a picture of them up. I am aware it's all masculine. There's like three girls, but not the cast. Yeah, go ahead, pick a picture. There we are. Yeah. I think I'd be one of those. I have a group who wants to do it as well.
I see you as the girl, the woman in red.
Yeah, she's the sister. So, and that's funny. Like, if you've never seen the Peaky Blinders, basically, I think they're in London, and it's back in the 1940s? Is that when the, what are they called? Yeah, we'll do the set, yeah. Birmingham.
1919.
Okay, I was so wrong. I haven't seen it in a while. But yeah, so basically they're kind of like crime lords, but they try and be good. That's very interesting. That's me. I guess going towards Dr. Lee's like 50-pound bag of cocaine. That's where I'm at. That's where I go in my head.
Well, it's whatever freedom
they're
lane
bad.
It paves for you.
Basically.
That's the most important thing.
Well, it's interesting that you were touching on a religion and how that kind of coincides with this paranormal mindset, with characters, with Halloween.
Yeah.
You even were mentioning someone who kind of was into Halloween, who was kind of in the religious sector.
Right.
I think... again, I mentioned cultural aspect too. In psychology, schizophrenia in America might be possession in another mm-hmm. culture.
Yeah.
And I guess a psychologist thinking about those type of things and being aware of it, of how as we kind of grew as a species, we try to make sense of the world. We try to make sense of the normal and abnormal, the things that can't be explained and things that could be explained. And then we try to explain them, I guess, more so. So we try to explain the unexplainable. And I think in a sense, we're giving it structure of that must have been a ghost, that could be paranormal. That was the gods, that was a god. The sunrise, right, is mm-hmm. caused by X. And then as science kind of evolved, it's been able to answer these. But there's the unanswerable sometimes. And there's still the unanswerables of, are there spirits? Are there paranormal? And I think that continues to create this nice illusion for us as human beings to kind of trick our minds, to kind of be exciting, to have the unexplained. Because if you know the answer, it's not as exciting as kind of the mystery, the yeah. stories, the Frankensteins, the werewolves, the Draculas. That's an exciting tale of what happened. Why did somebody disappear? What did I see in that blurry photo?
Well, you always hear that haunted story of, you know, there was a psychiatric patient who busted out mm-hmm. of a hospital mm-hmm. and became this enraged lunatic. So I think when the stereotype of crazy mm-hmm. is associated with fear, mm-hmm. and what's more better to accommodate fear than the concept of Halloween. Mm. It's all about, it's okay to frighten. It's okay to scare. It's encouraged.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, okay to be different.
Yeah. My kids went to a local grade school in Fairless Hills that had a 60-year history of celebrating Halloween. And when I tell you this elementary school was above and beyond, they would transform the entire lobby into a themed area. They would convert two full classrooms into a haunted house where they would have volunteers for a day to convert and change walls and bring in all kinds of scary characters, carriages, bales of hay into the school. They would completely transform it. And the eighth grade class every year would get a lockdown sleepover inside the gym.
That's awesome.
And the teachers were completely immersed in their roles. And for that one night, it was just an incredible transformation. So again, it allows for everyone to be something that they're not, to kind of take that risk-taking journey. Was that ghost blacking you, by the way?
I have no idea, but if anybody gets to see the background.
I know exactly how podcast Mike missed that, but we're going to have to debrief that after the show.
Well, half of what you were saying kind of reminds me, on here, Michael wants me to introduce my mom, which I have before. When you said kind of the crazy, insane person kind of breaks out, that happens often at my mom's job. And she kind of just like laughs. She's like, someone tried to run away again. I'm like, what? She's like, yeah, they tried to run away again. I was like, did you find them? Nah, they're not going anywhere. They have like 50 miles. They think they're home free and then they hit a fence. And there's people just waiting for them. It's really horrible. Everything goes on code. And she's like, all right. But I have mentioned my mother before. She's been a psychiatric nurse for about 30 years, 30 plus years. She used to work on the civil side. For those of you who aren't familiar with the term, civil is more chronic, like schizophrenia, what you would think of abnormal psychology. She has recently been moved to the opposite of civil, which is now in the prisons. And she says, even for her, she said it's very eerie going into. You can pull up a picture of Norristown State Hospital if you want. So she works in a very old building. And she said the one cool thing she mentioned, and then I can kind of see what you guys think, what this brings to mind.
This is right out of like a Halloween movie set.
She said there's a section of where she works that is the medical building. And in the medical buildings where the surgeries happen, I don't know if they still happen, but she said they have not moved the lobotomy tools, the shock therapy tools. Like, everything is the same. And she said she doesn't really know how she feels about it. Yeah, look how these are just creepy. Yeah.
It looks like a movie set.
Yeah. There she is. No.
I think a big thing that you were talking about, and it kind of gave me an interesting idea as a psychologist, if you went through a haunted house and try to de-escalate a situation in terms of talking with somebody who, right, they tend to act psychotic and they're like, come here. And I worked in the Philadelphia area with severe mentally ill. They were either homeless or they were had drug addiction or they got in trouble with the law. And the facility that I worked with, shout out ACT Team 3, which is a sort of community treatment teams, we worked with people to provide housing, provide vocational training. They would get a weekly stipend, sometimes only just $10, just so that they weren't spending it too much. And then, that they had their medication, all that stuff, that it was just maintained so that they can have a suitable life. And when you actually interact with those type of people, they have their traumas, they have their challenges, they have their stressors. They try to hold jobs. Some of them have housing and choose not to live in their housing. Either through paranoia or the people who are surrounding that area, they don't just want to be near of. And it's just thinking about when our perception of crazy or perception of mental illness, perception of what we kind of fear, how fear is kind of maybe through Hollywood stereotypes, maybe through the media, maybe through just our interactions one time.
Just a little through the media.
It starts to skew our beliefs, our perception.
Yeah.
But when you actually work with them day in and day out, and the people who are still doing that today, I commend them. And it's challenging work, and they're doing, you know, the best that they can with difficult situations and helping these people live the most normalized lives they can. But on occasion, they still might have a schizo break. They might still get manic. And that's scary to the normal person who doesn't know how to necessarily cope with that or deal with that.
That's, in my opinion, some of the realest work that can be done in the field of psychology. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly not taking anything away from what we do here and with our outpatient clinical services. When you're working with people at that level, you're dealing with not only serious mental illness, but typically those patterns have been ingrained for years. Mm-hmm. And it's so incredibly difficult to, one, establish trust, two, make any kind of consistent headway with real behavioral change, because their environment is so hostile, mm-hmm. at times volatile, and it makes it that much more difficult for them to find any kind of emotional stability.
Mm-hmm.
So to your point, serious work at the realist level.
Yeah.
And
we used to talk a little bit and just did in different places, and Pennsylvania, and I know other states have done this too. They did a deinstitutionalization where they shut down a lot of the psychiatric hospitals because of the practices that they were doing that were unethical and inhumane at times. And they kind of released them into the world and said, go function. And that's now rampant. And this group of people that I was working with, they're really the frontline people that people don't even know. People don't, you know, what they do or how they're interacting with the world, but helping you live your more normal lives kind of behind the scenes. Think about like 007, like you don't actually know what's going on in the dark shadows. They're in those dark shadows and maintaining. So somebody who's not kind of crapping on your front lawn, like, or smashing your windows, they're literally helping you maintain a sense of normalcy, and you get to go around about your life and feel normal and comfortable. And it's these people who are doing this kind of behind the scenes to help manage mental health in those communities. So shout out to those people. Yeah,
she's definitely a special kind of person. Everybody who talks to her, she'll tell her stories and they're like, I cannot do it. You do. But what's really nice about it is my mom has actually, you know, these people are so far gone, but they like her and they don't like everybody. And they tell her, and they'll be like, she left. And she said it, she was crying. And I was like, you're like, she's like, I just know them so well. There's people, there's a man who, just to give you an idea of who she would work with, this older gentleman who's chronically there forever. He was in jail, got moved into the civil side for her. He killed every one of his wives. The main one was she was pregnant, and he cut the dead baby out of her, or he cut the baby out of her stomach and put a dead cat in there. So that's who my mom kind of works with. He came up to her and said, you can't leave. And she was like, why? And she talks to them like anybody else. And he's like, well, because we like you. You're the only one that, like, that's nice here. My mom will bring them candy. Like, she genuinely likes what she does. And I think a lot of the workers that she's told me, at least, are kind of there more of forced sometimes. So it's nice that to know, like, there's definitely malpractice that happens still. But there's people like my mom who genuinely likes it. And does the best she can. So now she's totally away from the people. Mm. The prisons are different. She doesn't even really see them.
What I find very interesting about that is when you hear about that description of that particular individual, that would typically elicit fear,
right,
for the mass majority of people. But yet there's some people who can do that job, like your mom, who goes to bed listening or watching to ghost time stories. But others are fascinated by paranormal activity, and others won't even come within 10 feet of any screening of it.
Right.
So I just find it interesting what we define as fearful, what we define as a being afraid. I think so much of it has to do with our, I feel like I'm something's happening to me. Something's overcoming me. I'm getting reverb from my I just so desperately want to continue to laugh. It just bubbles up inside of me. Again, the beauty of the mask allows us to truly let out our inner whatever at that moment, which I think society so often encourages us that we need to inhibit. that we need to repress. Mm-hmm. And it's people like your mom that can kind of see beyond the veil of someone's what we would call clinical disorder.
Yeah.
And just connect with them at the human level. And I think that a fear so often gets in the way for us of doing that in our everyday lives.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pull out our mindfulness card today, because I think this is a very
interesting.
This is a very good segue into kind of what we've been discussing. And so as I try to read this with my eyes,
just sense it.
The name of the card is When Is My Mind?
When?
When is my mind?
When is my mind?
When is my mind? Okay. So it's take 1 minute and count on your hands how many times your mind goes to the past, to the future, or somewhere else. Let's just take a minute. And you can do this at home as well as you're listening, and just take a minute. And just think about, you know, how many times does your mind go to the past or the future or somewhere else? Then return to the present for a rest.
So my stomach has been growling the entire show. And I think Jess heard it earlier. I know.
It's the like, fruit's not doing it for you?
No, it is, but I can't consume it at the normal rate without becoming like the freaky killer clown. You see?
Yeah, I mean.
And I'm totally immersed in my role, so I'm not going to break stride from that. But I was actually concerned that my stomach was going to growl during our little mindful moment.
Uh-huh.
It's very, very hard for me not to go to the past or the future, simply because of things that are going on in my personal life and my kids and running a practice. So what was interesting for me was I tried to get back to basics of some of the basic diaphragmatic breathing that I've been teaching for over a decade to try to just recall some level of simple centering.
Very nice.
Simple centering.
Yes.
So I've been, I try as much as I can when I remember, when I wake up, before I go to bed, in the middle of the day, if I have some time, I will actively try and continuously always strengthen my concentration muscle, which is meditation, is how I do it through mindfulness. So I kind of went into my, I've been doing it so much that I kind of went into my meditational type of mindset where I'm literally just focusing on breathe in, breathe out. But, I counted about four times I went to the future and the past while doing that.
Yeah. Similar to both of you, kind of being mindful of my own breath in that moment, kind of hearing my breath a little bit through the mic as their feedback. And then also my mind kind of going to different places, especially with events coming up in my life. Again, it kind of is natural to go at something that kind of my where my mind went as well is like the very act of me talking about the present and the future kind of made me think about the not think about a penguin scenario where I ask you to not think about a penguin. And the only thing you can think about is a penguin or not thinking about a penguin, which is in fact is you're actually thinking about the penguin. So that's kind of the mentality that I kind of drifted into of like trying not to think about the future, trying to think about the past versus just allowing myself to be in the present. And so I guess trying to resist something actually encourages it to occur more.
Very profound from just a big angry ape.
I feel like it's leading us into our last part, which is psychoanalyze Halloween characters. From the helmet.
Do we need to? Can we make this thing move or something?
It's
sitting there the whole time.
I thought you would never ask.
Oh my God,
literally.
It's such a prep. You don't, you know. There you go. Very solid introduction. So what are we? What kind of do we have a cast full of characters in there?
Yes.
Okay. Let Jess go first, please. She's just been dying to.
You don't want to listen to it again?
Sure.
We have to always do it when we're doing this. There we go.
There you go.
Yep, she's got one.
I'm going to have to Google this person, but maybe you guys. Does anyone know Jason Voorhees? Oh, is he Jason?
Yeah, Jason.
He's Jason.
It's Friday the 13th.
Okay. Well,
actually,
there he is.
Actually, that's quite a good one.
That's a great poll.
Yeah.
All right.
That's a top-tier player.
So when you're psychoanalyzing something, what is the first thing that we should do?
Well, I think the first thing we got to do is try to ask ourselves, do we know any history about this character? I'm going to take the lead a little, simply because this is, I'm pretty sure, an 80s movie. And Jason had all kinds of issue with his, wait for it, little drum roll, please.
Mother.
Jason had issues with his mother.
Typical.
And Jason drowned in Crystal Lake, which is the name of the lake at a summer camp, and comes back incredibly pissed off with all kinds of mommy issues.
Mm-hmm.
In a nutshell, he has superhuman strength. He wears a mask because he is rotten from decaying at the bottom of Crystal Lake for a number of years. And his preferred weapon is the machete.
Sometimes depicted wrongly with a really chainsaw sometimes.
Yes.
But it's mainly machete.
Mainly the machete. Oh. And of course, the infamous hockey mask.
Right.
Which covers up his decaying face, which I believe they do have some close-up shots of worms crawling out of his face.
Hmm.
Okay.
Just in case anyone was wondering.
Yeah. So I know it, but I have never really seen it. And I was going to Google, but I think it'd be better for the analysis if I just took from what you guys are saying and added to the conversation that way.
All right.
So we know that he has some mommy issues. Why?
I think those issues are pretty nondescript.
Just like his mom was mean to him. Did she drown him?
A little bit of trauma.
I don't assuming. I don't remember
neglect
the exact.
If he drowned?
I don't remember the exact. I think he might have fallen out of a rowboat.
Okay.
In Crystal Lake. I don't know if that was maternal neglect.
Maybe she chose not to save him.
Right. Podcast Mike is doing extensive
research.
Yeah,
he is. He's going heavy here.
He's going the backstory.
Yeah. Okay.
Can you share some of those details?
His early life.
His early life. Crystal Lake.
Mm-hmm.
1946.
Hydrocephalus.
That's when he was born.
Okay.
Who knew there was such a backstory on Jason?
Single mother.
So the mom was hired for a summer camp.
Isolated from the community.
Right, so the mom...
not letting him attend school or education.
Okay.
He was bullied because he spent most of his time with his mother, leading everyone to think that he wasn't really that intelligent.
So kind of pushing on more of like the antisocial behavior.
And it looks as if he was trying to escape his cruel bulliers, and they caught up to him on the deck and actually threw him into the water in Crystal Lake, where he presumably drowned.
So is that the type of person he seeks out when he's killing his bullies?
Oh, the counselors as well, because they were supposed to be on the lookout for that type of misbehavior, but were
and his last words were actually for his mother.
Activities.
So does he go after moms often?
Well, let's just think. Well, hold on. Let's just kind of back it up. Let's just think about a child in general who is bullied. What might be one of the common themes that gets activated with a parent if that bullying is happening?
As a mother?
Mm-hmm.
I think the mother, well, I think there's different ones here, but I feel like first she gets defensive and wants to like seek out. Like, I know it's common for, like, a mom. I'm talking about, like, a super normal mom, not Jason's mother. To kind of, like, reach out to, like, the school, get people involved, say this shouldn't happen, which then, you know, the kid's like, why would you do that? Now I'm going to even be even more bullied. I feel like that's not the route I was supposed to go.
No.
They can definitely get that protective. I think they pull them closer. They tend to pull them closer to protect them in some way.
Not go to school anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm. Don't go out. Don't be around those type of people.
Right. Trying to sort of teach those life lessons, right?
Nurturing.
But also from the perception of the child, which maybe could explain some of Jason Voorhees' repressed anger towards his mother, is maybe he felt that mom should have stepped up to do more in trying to protect him or to intervene as a parent to make sure that he was getting the support that if he had gotten, maybe never would have led to the incident to begin with.
Interesting sentence here. Her husband, was that Elijah?
Elias.
Left sometime after the birth of Jason, which was his father. He left his wife and child behind because he could not handle Pamela, Jason's mother's slightly unbalanced obsession with her son.
So there was maybe some codependency between Mama and Jason Voorhees.
So she drove until she found a lakeside community.
I believe that was the Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
So is there music. Such a thing as too much love? Is that called overcoddling? Well, like I feel like the mother at some point loved Jason.
Well, there was definitely love there, but
why did that become so like wry? When did that go awry?
When she's not allowing her kid to experience the world in terms of isolation, in terms of not allowing him to go to school.
Or an over expression of love can actually delay development.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not so much a question of was love there, but how intense was that communication of it, and to what degree does it impact the child?
Because of it, there's an element of attachment to it. If this person is always their safety net, they're always looking for mom. Mm-hmm. So if they're ever detached from mom in some way, that separation anxiety sometimes arises, fear of the outside, inability to cope effectively when you are an individual.
Very Freudian story.
Jason. Mm-hmm. Jason Voorhees.
So what would your final...
what sort of disorder does Jason suffer from? Dr. Angry Ape.
Well, he doesn't have a lot of emotions. Mm-hmm. Or does he, right? That's the question.
Or does he?
Is he like emotionally
Just because
driven?
He is silent. Is he engaging in selective mutism?
Because he does make grunts and stuff like that, so he might have the ability. Unless
he does grunt.
Fully articulate, but through the decaying vocal box, so he can't really truly make a few sounds. But maybe there's a selective mutism. I don't know. I haven't seen enough of the movies if he sees hallucinations in some capacity. Again, in a brief kind of not meeting him and not working with him and just watching, I guess there's definitely a psychopathological drive for a need of feeling powerful in some capacity.
Right. Some
over his
bullying. Some level of control, right? So he's overcompensating for that moment, which we are assuming he recalls, in which he was bullied. He was not empowered in any real traditional sense, which led to his premature death. Jason's pissed off, but he also wants to kind of right his wrongs, and in that effort very much tries to get control back in his life, but his inability to effectively exercise that need just transforms into mindless violence. How was that?
Good poll,
Jessica. I feel like he has some, considering his upbringing, can we even look at some developmental issues that kind of push
into? Well, he had hydrocephalitis, it looks like, an enlarged skull.
Oh, yeah.
Can you just scroll up a little bit, podcast mic, back to a little down a little bit more? Keep going. Life before the mass killing sprees.
Yeah.
It actually says that he... No, right there. It says that he did not drown. And he made it to land safely. But having no idea how to seek help, he decided his only action was to wait for his mother to find him. where he built a home and managed to occupy this an abandoned shanty in the woods. And during those years, his mother never found him. So this kind of compounds the issue. It actually completely shatters my preconceived notion, my decades of thinking that he drowned in Crystal Lake, which is definitely assumed and therefore passively communicated to the viewing audience through the Friday the 13th.
He got murdered by series. His mom. I don't know where, I just jumped into the middle of this paragraph, but Pamela murdered him and almost all of his employees with the machete. There's the machete.
Enraged by Steve's actions, so that must have been one of the bullies.
Steve Christie, the son of Camp Crystal Lake founder David. Yeah, tried to reopen.
So the mom had some killer tendencies as well.
There we go.
So decapitated Pamela with a machete.
Getting more and more interesting.
Hold on, wait for it. As the investigation of the murders, only for herself, Pamela, that is, to be pulled into the water by a reverent form of Jason's prepubescent self. Look at that. You want to talk about Freudian? You want to talk about, actually, Erikson in the psychosocial stages of development? Anybody? Would anybody like to throw their head into that ring, compounded by the machete?
Could there be some personality disorders happening within
this? Just a few. Just a small pinch of that. Well, you have your codependency, right? You have your, we would call that an affectionate cluster.
And when you have more than...
When you have more than one, when you're symptomatic of a host of personality disorders, that's referred to as a cluster. All right, shall we move on? Mr. Angry Ape, would you like to select?
Do we want to do another one?
Yeah. Do one more.
Oh, hold on. Now you're ready.
I have one in my hand, but I have two in my hand.
When it's done, you have to be done.
Freddy Krueger.
Wow.
Yeah. Freddy versus Jason action.
Uh-oh.
How about that?
Is the most clinically
insane.
Wasn't he
a firefighter who got burned?
Now, there is a side bit to Freddy Krueger, which now that I am faced with his
mom was a nun.
The huge element that the name of the movie is Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes.
You have a question.
You're
bursting with wanting to know something.
I was listening and I read the first sentence of his life story. Let me just say it. Amanda Krueger was a nun working in a hospital and was raped by over 100 psychopaths. She became pregnant with a son who was named Freddy. That's where I stopped. Okay. But
the one key element to Freddy Krueger, though, is Freddy only can hurt you. Does anybody know this?
In your sleep.
After you fall asleep.
Your dreams.
Pourquoi?
Right. Why?
Yeah.
Because that's where he lives. He lives in your dream state. But what happens is once you fall asleep, that gives him power to actually hurt you.
Okay.
And once you are hurt in your dreams, that translates to reality. So there's a whole angle to the Nightmare on Elm Street where people know that Freddy exists. It's a totally different slant. People know what Freddy is capable of, and all they're trying to do is stay awake because they know if they fall asleep, they can fall victim to...
Yeah, it's interesting that he's such a powerful character, yet he has a lot of vulnerabilities and weaknesses. Like, he's afraid of fire.
The burns.
Yeah.
He's sustained.
He's afraid of holy power.
Priests. Interesting.
And his mom was a nun?
Mm-hmm.
The other piece, which is not effectively communicated in the movies, is that it says each soul that he takes grants him the attributes of the victim.
So it gets stronger and stronger.
Gets stronger and stronger, which is not really effectively communicated, which would be very hard to in a 2-hour movie. But I find the interesting element of sleep and sleep deprivation to be a crucial point of difference, really, into, because if you stay awake, Freddy has no power.
Right.
But somehow, some way, because our human need to sleep, really to survive, mm-hmm. supersedes that.
Right.
But then by default puts us in more danger.
Mm-hmm. I found an article of like five psychologists who sat and watched this movie and actively diagnosed the mother and Freddy. And I really want to find what they came up with.
So it just says that headline? It doesn't say what they found?
It kind of says like they... So it says second year resident gathered. So I guess it was him and some others.
And then so students. It says that he killed about 20 children before he was burned alive by his parents.
By the parents.
Of Elm Street, therefore the Nightmare on Elm Street, where he was killed. He then took 40 more lives after he fused with dream demons and became able to enter the dreams from 1981 to 1989.
So we're okay now.
Where everyone's okay now. And then, of course, if you want more details, you can always check out Freddy's Major Kills. And what that actually includes.
Go ahead.
I just kind of want to wrap things up and sort of ask the global question. What have we learned more about ourselves in what masks we have chosen to wear today? And how does that impact Halloween, the paranormal, and what we go through our daily lives as everyday people?
I think you should start.
No.
Look at yours.
I think the biggest element, the biggest element I think is, what mask do we wear on a daily basis? But on Halloween, do we get to actually shed that mask and kind of be our true selves? Or is it the opposite? Are we wearing a mask on that day? And I think Halloween is, again, our ability and our allowance to kind of have that freedom that we've talked about, allows ourselves to kind of be on the edge or the outskirts and kind of get scared, while also kind of challenging ourselves to kind of have confidence to overcome things, and ultimately at the end of the day, I think, to get excited. And I think there's if you don't feel like you're excited every day of the year, you know, holidays, especially Halloween, kind of gets you excited in a new and interesting way.
Jessica.
Okay. So I'm going to go on the more personal path. Considering our talk about spirits, it is said that the infants and children under a certain age are more likely to be encountered by a spirit and not even know, just because of how they're still connected potentially with the other side. I don't know how it works. I do know that when I was younger, I would not wear shoes outside, which is a very big deal. Dr. Lee, as you know, with your children, you imagine if your daughter would refuse to wear shoes outside. Because I wanted, my reasoning, as a creepy child, was I felt closer to the earth with my bare feet. Mm-hmm. And now that I have this witch hat on, I think it kind of makes sense that I chose to wear a witch hat, because they're all about the elements of the earth. When you look at Wicca in particular, it's all elements, and I think astrology, perhaps, how they all relate. So why did I choose this? I don't really, I'm bringing out that more like earth quality of myself, I guess, who I wanted to be when I was little. I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. So for me personally, when you think about the concept of Halloween and the paranormal, it's one of those special times that you, when you both, if you go down that path someday, become a parent, you get to revisit your own dreams, fears, fantasies through your children, and watching them get so excited to be something that they are not one time a year. And I thought you brought up an excellent point. The mask that we wear every day, in large part, does come with the price of admission in being part of traditional society. It's encapsulated by the work that we choose, the settings that we place ourselves in, the friends that we associate with, we are constantly wearing masks. And I think the greater point for me is there's a killer clown within me. And my opportunity here today to kind of live that, to express that, really has been therapeutic. I'm also sweating my ass off with this mask and this wig, so I'm going to have to kind of make those subtle adjustments. I need an internal cooling mechanism for next year so I can maintain a certain body temp. But in living it, very often as I work with clients or I say to people, the best way that I know how to teach is by modeling the very behavior that I promote. And for me today, what I felt that I promoted was just that inner demonic killer clown that maybe takes pleasure in things that other people don't. And that's okay. And as long as we recognize in ourselves that we can be really anybody who we want to be and then become comfortable enough to express ourselves, that's really living the life best served. So, in my own special words, my name is Dr. Lee Piccirillo.
Dr. Hunter Stevens.
And Jessica.
Thanks so much for watching another edition of The Head Game, powered by Mindful Athlete Training. And happy Halloween.